So today we're continuing with verses 3:11 to 3:13, which read as follows. Kuso yatha dukahito hatame vanukantati samanyang duparamathang nirayayupakadhati yang kinchi siti langkamang sankilitancha yang matang sankasarang brahmacharyang natang hoti mahapalang kaira che kaira thenang dalhamenang parakame siti lohi paribajo bhiyo akirate rajang, which means just as grass improperly grasped cuts the hand, the life of a recluse improperly upheld pulls one to hell. Lazy work, corrupted duties, the spiritual life, a dubious spiritual life, these don't bring great fruit. If one were to do this, one should do it well. One should do it with steadfast effort. A lazy renunciant spreads ever more impurity. So these verses, which are some of the more famous verses in Buddhist circles, were taught in response to a fairly simple story of two monks. So the story goes that there was one monk at the time that the Buddha was dwelling in Jetavana, near Savatthi. This one monk who was very much dedicated to the Buddha's teaching, it seems, but a little bit unmindful. And one day he unconsciously, unthinkingly, pulled a blade of grass, broke off a blade of grass. And realizing what he had done, as he absent-mindedly did this, he was consumed by guilt, or he felt guilty, because it's a monk's rule not to break any living plant. And so he got quite worried about this, wondering what was going to happen to him now that he had broken this rule. So he went to a certain monk, the second monk, and he said this to the second monk. He said, "Look, I've broken this rule. What's going to happen?" And the other monk looked at him and kind of laughed, and he said, "How can you possibly think something would happen to you? It's just a rule. You confess it, and that's it. That's just what happens. You break the rule, you confess it. Nothing happens to you." And he says, "Look," and he reached down, grabbed two handfuls of grass, and pulled them out. I don't think he cut himself, but I don't think it mentions. Anyway, two fistfuls of grass and pulled them out and said, "See, nothing happened." Now, word got around to the Buddha about this affair, and he chastised the second monk. And isn't recorded that he said anything except for these three verses, but the implication was clear that he didn't consider this to be a wise response to the first monk. And that's it. That's the story. So what the story, what's interesting about this story is I think you can say both of the monks were in the wrong. The first monk was in the wrong because he was feeling guilty about what he had done. It's called kukucha. And kukucha is one of the five hindrances. It means worry, or sometimes translated as guilt. But in general, it just means when you're worried about something. Even if you're worried about something bad that you've done, the worry doesn't help. It doesn't make repairs. It doesn't make amends for what you've done. It doesn't even prevent you from doing what you doing the bad deed again. And furthermore, it's completely unconnected with the ethical nature of the act. There's nothing unethical about plucking grass, so feeling worried about it is not even accurate. The second monk was right to that extent, that there's nothing unethical about plucking a great blade of grass from a Buddhist perspective. There's nothing meaningful about it. However, when a monk plucks a blade of grass, even a single blade of grass, it does have meaning. It has significant meaning because it's against the rules. And so the real lesson that's interesting for us as meditators, well, besides the fact that you have to be clear about worry and guilt, feelings of guilt about things that you may have done, that they aren't the answer, they don't fix the problem, they aren't adequate restitution for what you've done, even if what you've done is unethical. But also interesting is this idea that something can be wrong even though it's not unethical. Because there comes monks, both ethnically Buddhist and foreigners, newcomers to Buddhism, who discount the monastic rules as being superfluous, trivial, unimportant, flaunt the breaking of the rules and dismiss them with snide remarks, dismiss monks who would keep the rules. And there's something true about the stance that, well, things like breaking blade of grass, digging in the earth, even using money, there's nothing intrinsically unethical about it. But there's two reasons why the stance is dangerous, to say the least, potentially irreparably harmful to oneself and to Buddhism. The first is that there's many rules that are not directly, or many practices that are not directly ethical or unethical, but have, I guess what you could say, extrinsic purpose. So moving away from monks, because it's not that interesting for meditators to learn about, it's not that useful. But the same issue we see crop up with meditators as well. For example, meditators who would rather sit first and then walk, who don't see any reason why they shouldn't sit first and then walk, or give up walking meditation entirely. They say, I prefer to sit. Sitting seems like enough to me. Why do I have to walk? It's an example that we come across. And it's a good example of where just because you don't know the reason doesn't mean there isn't one. And a really valid reason for us following instruction is because we just don't understand the benefit. So newcomers often don't understand the benefit of walking meditation, both physically and mentally. There's value in changing postures to help break up any kind of rut that you've gotten stuck in, which easily happens with just sitting, for example. And there's reasons for doing walking first, because walking, as said by the Buddha, and as evinced by the actual experience of meditators, has benefits when preceding the sitting meditation. The concentration that you cultivate during walking, the Buddha said, it lasts so it lasts into the sitting practice. Just as an example. There's lots of stuff like that where meditators often think they know better, which brings us to the second reason. There are many practices, many norms, and this goes for the monk's life. There's many norms about how to act. But it also is even, I think, more obvious in meditation practice. There's many things that have absolutely no intrinsic meaning. When we walk, when we do walking meditation, we walk with the right foot first. Some of you might not have known that. You might have read or skipped over that part in the book, and for sure, nobody read it thinking this is ethically significant or has any deeper meaning to it, hopefully. In fact, if you thought there was a deeper meaning to the fact that we walk with the right foot first, then that's another issue. That's where this goes wrong, and that's why people are often condescending when they read these things or hear about the need to do certain things that are absolutely meaningless. They think it's an attachment to rites and rituals, which is a big deal in Buddhism. If you're attached to something like walking with the right foot, something silly like this, walking with the right foot first, if you're attached to that and say, that's important, if you don't do that, you're not going to become enlightened, or if you do that, you're sure to become enlightened, this is called adherence to rites and rituals, which is a serious problem. Something that you become free from through practice because you realize there is no intrinsic meaning. But there's a very, very valid reason for doing things exactly as you've been told. And it's that the reason for not doing things as you've been told is most commonly view, like attachment to views. I'm right. Conceit. I know better. I'm better than this. These people don't know. This person doesn't know as well as I do. Or attachment, craving. I don't like doing like this. I prefer doing it like that. A really good reason for doing things exactly as you've been told is because from time to time you're not going to want to do them as you've been told. So if your practice is to say, today I prefer it like this, and the next day say, today I prefer it like that, you're never given the opportunity to face the fact that you prefer one thing over another for no reason. There's no good reason to prefer this or over that. If there is, if, for example, you have an injury and you can't do certain practices or certain aspects of the practice, it's absolutely valid to express that or to make those sorts of decisions. But quite often, our reasons for choosing to do things a certain way are this: views, our belief, we believe certain things to be right or wrong, that have no basis in reality, or conceit, thinking, I'd rather do it like this, it must be right, it's right for me, that sort of thing. And craving, because you prefer one thing over another, you like it this way makes you bored or makes you uncomfortable or this sort of thing. It's similar to how you may not have realized, but a good reason for doing exactly the same amount of walking as sitting and to use a timer for walking and sitting has this extrinsic value. There's no intrinsic value to having exactly the same amount of walking or sitting. Sometimes maybe a little more walking would be better. Sometimes maybe there's some moments, but how do you tell that? And more importantly, how do you distinguish that from just preferring one over the other? Because this happens, as you've almost likely experienced. Today or this time you prefer more walking, and then suddenly you prefer more sitting. Most people, before they've practiced, they prefer sitting. If they've done other practices where there's just sitting, they'll prefer the sitting for sure in the beginning. But give it some time, and throughout the course you'll find it just randomly changes, where today you don't want to sit at all and you'd rather just do walking, or you prefer walking, or that sort of thing. It's completely, there's no intrinsic reason for preferring one over the other. And so keeping it artificially imposed, you will walk this much, you will sit this much, or where your teacher tells you, today you will walk this much and sit this much and so on. And then eventually getting it up to 1 hour walking, 1 hour sitting, and just keeping it there and never deviating has this value, because there's nothing, there's no reason why it could be hugely beneficial to deviate from that. If there were some reason, then you could entertain it. But the reason is always, almost always going to be, I just prefer it like that today. Which is a great reason to not do it, because what we're engaging in here is a training of the mind. A training of the mind to face and to let go. Which you can't accomplish if you're always avoiding and clinging. So I think that's what's most interesting about this idea of why would it be wrong to pluck a blade of grass? Why would the Buddha chastise this monk for demonstrating that it's completely ethically fine to do so? Because it's against the rules. And there are reasons. There's always reasons for the rules. Some of them are, I mean, if you're confused about why it might be wrong, there's reasons for keeping monks from cultivating, trimming hedges or so on. Lots of things that monks could engage in that would distract them from their practice. And other reasons as well. And sometimes it's just communal harmony for some of the rules and so on. For meditators, it's often just more like, do it this way, because sometimes you're not going to want to do it this way. And so having it imposed from the outside saves you or protects you from partiality. There will be times where you don't want to do things a certain way. And also, because of the challenge of being told what to do is hard for some people. It's hard to be told what to do, and something in you, the little child, I guess, wants to rebel and say, huh, they can't tell me what to do. And it's meaningless. This conceit comes up and you believe, you look down on the idea and you think, huh, I'll show them, I'll just do it my way. And you feel proud because you're not falling for this sort of, you know, it's all pride and arrogance and conceit and craving and clinging. Don't do that. The ability to let go and follow instructions, it might seem dangerous from a freedom point of view, you know, this feeling like no one can tell me what to do. But that's not wholesome. It's not valuable. It doesn't help you to let go. Now, it goes without saying that you shouldn't just do anything anyone says. And if there is ethical ramifications to acts, you absolutely should never follow anyone's instruction. If someone tells you to do something unethical in any way, then. And also, if someone tells you to do something that's going to cause injury, you should be mindful of the limits of what's proper to be doing. So that's the story. The verses, each verse is a little bit different. So the first verse makes a bold claim that if you live the spiritual life improperly, it can actually harm you. It can actually drag you to hell. It's the saying of pull you to hell. Sometimes we practice with an external appearance of spirituality or holiness. This is something common among monks. There are many people in monk's robes who aren't actually holy or spiritual in any way. Some engaging in absolutely terrible practices, breaking even the five precepts. And nothing about being a monk will protect those people. In fact, there's the idea that it's even worse, because they're taking food given out of respect and reverence. They're living like parasites in a way. Well, maybe parasite isn't exact. People are giving willingly to these people, but the Buddha called these people thieves. They're stealing that food because they're faking. They're fake. They're not real. You can see this mostly in monks. I don't think it's very common for meditators to just pretend to be meditators, but it is certainly possible to cultivate a meditation practice that has issues. It has problems. It's not likely to drag you to hell, but certainly possible to cause you problems. Like, for example, a meditator might develop the bad habit of aversion, the bad habit of avoiding experiences that increases the amount of disliking, of anger that they have in their mind. A meditator might be very much attached to pleasant experiences. Some meditators, not in our tradition, but We have heard people ask about listening to music during meditation, even people asking about taking drugs during meditation or that sort of thing. There's certainly misunderstandings about the meditation practice that can cause issues. But it's common to have problems arise during meditation, and so it's important to understand that just because you're doing walking, just because you're doing sitting, doesn't mean you're actually progressing, you're actually benefiting. If you're not mindful, if you're not honest, if you're not facing your experiences, if you're giving in to greed, giving in to anger, giving in to delusion, then it can actually make you a worse person. You know, it can actually help you cultivate bad habits. You spend an hour sitting, worrying, or even intellectualizing, philosophizing, or this sort of thing. If you are proud of your practice and conceited about your practice, or adhering to beliefs and superstitions and this sort of thing. It's important to understand that proper understanding. I guess the takeaway for meditators here is to understand the practice well, understand the theory behind it well, and always try your best to follow it. The second verse points out the idea of being lazy or sketchy or half-hearted, of breaking from your practice. So I guess you could include here the idea of not being mindful outside of practice. I had one experience at a meditation center where the meditators were instructed to do 8, 10, up to 12 hours of meditation a day. So when I got there and I was temporarily teaching them, I found that the meditators had been asked mostly to do 8 hours a day, or some different, I guess, that some 8, 10, eventually they give them more and more hours a day. But they weren't given any instruction outside of that. So whereas it sounds impressive to be doing 8 hours even of meditation a day, for the other, well, 8, 24 minus 8 is 16, minus, say, 6 hours for sleeping. For the other 10 hours, they just sat around and talked. They sat around and joked and discussed things outside of the practice, talking about, I don't know, politics or home life or comparing stories, chatting, joking. And it was causing a real headache for the international department. They were getting complaints from the Thai meditators, or from the Thai officials and monks and so on. And I identified that the real problem was that they had never been told to be mindful outside of practice, which follows this idea of a practice that is on and off. Sankasarang. I don't know exactly what sankasarang. It means something like dubious. I think it refers more to unethical behavior. But from the perspective of a meditator, it is fairly unethical. You know, the mind states of sitting around chatting are mostly unethical. There's a lot of greed and enjoyment of jokes and chatting and useless conversation. There can be anger, aversion, and when you sit around gossiping, oh, that person or that teacher or that monk or other religions or whatever you talk about can be unwholesome as far as being mean or unpleasant about other people. And delusion, of course, when you start getting caught up in ideas and concepts, your mind is not clear and focused on your actual experiences, not present, you know, living in the past, living in the future. And so I explained to them, I said, today and from now on, I want you to do 18 hours of meditation a day. Forget about 8. Now on, 18. And this one man came to me and he said, one boy came to me and he said, today I did 8 hours. And he was so relieved that he actually managed to do such a difficult thing. And I said, okay, today 18 hours. And his eyes just bulged. And I said, for formal practice, so here's how you're going to do it. With formal practice, do as much as you can comfortably. I'm not going to ask you how many hours you did. But from the moment you wake up till the moment you go to sleep, I want you to try your best to apply the same principles as you would during the formal practice. The moment you wake up, say to yourself, lying, lying. When you go to sit up, sitting, sitting. When you walk around, walking, walking. When you brush your teeth, brushing, brushing. When you eat, chewing, chewing. So I explained, as I explained to all of you. It changed overnight, the whole situation. It was like night and day. You could see the difference immediately. They had no time to sit around and chat. They were too busy being mindful. So it's an example of how it won't bring great fruit if you're on and off, if you have a dubious spiritual practice, like a spiritual practice that is sketchy. So I think this goes for not dedicating yourself to it, but I guess in general, outside of a meditation retreat, it means dedicating yourself in terms of your intention or your direction. So not going back to unwholesome ways or engaging in practices that are contrary to the spiritual life. Because the second verse says, it just won't bring great fruit. You get what you put into it is the point. You can't just say you're a meditator, or you can't just come here and say, I'm going to stay here for 21 days, 26 days, and that's going to graduate me from the meditation course. Then I can say I've graduated, I've successfully completed the course. You can only say that if you actually had success. And success doesn't come from the time that you spent here. It doesn't come from the completion of some sort of course. It comes from what you put into it. The third verse says something a little bit different. It says the same sort of things about being lazy. The third verse says, if you're going to do something, do it with wholehearted, steadfast effort, because a lazy renunciate spreads ever more impurity, rajang, which means dust, dirt, mental defilement. But I think it's a play on words, because someone who is a renunciant means someone who has left the home life, and the home life is likened to a dusty road. Whereas renouncing is like living in the open air. Because when you are living in the home life, you're surrounded by people nagging and pulling at you and pulling and pushing and manipulating, and you have duties and dependencies and obligations. So the Buddha said it's like a dusty road. And the open air, the clean air, when you're free from all of that and you live without worldly attachments or pursuits. So the idea of you still collecting dust, even when you're living in the open air, you're kicking up the dust because of the laziness. So the point here is that not only does laziness or idleness or a lack of dedication, not only does it limit the fruit, the benefit of the practice, but at the same time, as I mentioned already, as I pointed out, during the time that you're not wholeheartedly cultivating the practice, you're also developing bad habits. So any time that you're not mindful, unmindfulness has the opportunity to arise. Greed has an opportunity, anger has an opportunity, delusion has an opportunity. A big reason for trying to be mindful outside of practice, it's not just getting more practice in. It's about keeping the supporting conditions alive and not canceling out all the goodness with idle chatter or worrying about the future or clinging to the past. So three important lessons there with the verses. The first verse, that if you practice improperly, if you're not clear on the right practice, spiritual life can actually be harmful. It's important to understand that spiritual life, meditation practice, is about training the mind. It's a deep dive into how the mind works. So there's a lot of influence. It's like opening up a machine or a computer. You can do a lot of harm if you don't know what you're doing. The mind is a very powerful machine. And the second, that if you don't work, if you aren't wholehearted in your practice, it won't bring great fruit. And third, not only will it not bring great fruit if you're lazy, but at the same time, even though you have good intentions, if you're not dedicating yourself to it, the idleness, the lack of dedication provides ripe breeding ground for unwholesomeness. Getting lazy means getting greedy and bored and angry and frustrated and deluded. Gives time for you to worry and doubt and speculate and cultivate views and opinions and so on. We don't need views and opinions, we need clarity, we need wisdom, seeing things as they are. These three verses, I said, are quite famous. They're a part of what is recited after the Patimokkha, after the monastic rules. So every couple of weeks, the monks will all get together and recite all the rules of the monks. And then after that, they have several verses that they recite in Thailand anyway, I think here as well. And these verses are one of them. Just a reminder for us to stay focused, to stay on track, and to really get the most out of what we're here for. We're not here on vacation. We're here to do something incredibly meaningful for ourselves and for the world, to better ourselves for our own benefit and for the benefit of those around us, to make the world a better place, but most importantly, to just benefit ourselves and free us from the stress and suffering that comes from craving and clinging and the pollution in our minds. So that, and the lesson from the story, to follow instruction, follow the rules, even though you might not understand them. Do what you're told, because it's a great practice of humility, if nothing else, and patience, if nothing else, to just go along with whatever you're told to do within reason. And that's the Dhammapada for today. Thank you for listening.